I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's November 10th, and we have a lot to talk about. Today is the day that the Trump administration joins 20 Republican attorneys general in asking the United States Supreme Court to invalidate the Affordable Care Act, eliminating all of the legal protections and putting access to health insurance at risk for people living with MS and every other pre-existing medical condition. I'm hopeful that the court either lets the Affordable Care Act stand and then Congress begins the task of improving it, or at the very least, finds a way to eliminate part but not all of the Affordable Care Act, leaving those protections for people with pre-existing conditions in place. If not, it's going to create massive financial hardship for millions of American families. It's going to threaten access to health care. And it's going to all happen while we're in the midst of the greatest public health crisis of our lifetimes. Even if other healthcare legislation is introduced in Congress. Well, by now, I think we've all seen that introducing legislation in Congress is no guarantee that it gets passed. Historically, it's taken years to pass healthcare legislation in the United States. We're talking about a multi-billion dollar industry with no shortage of special interests with very deep pockets who are invested in the healthcare status quo. So my fingers are crossed. Tomorrow, we celebrate Veterans Day in the United States. It's an opportunity to honor the men and women who have served in America's armed forces. More than 70,000 of those U.S. veterans are actually living with MS, and today we're going to meet one of them. My guest is Carla Clay, an Air Force veteran and a National Veterans Wheelchair Games multiple medal winner. But before we get to my conversation with Carla Clay, there are a few other things that you should know about. I want to tell you about a first-of-its-kind collaboration between the National MS Society and 33 other national organizations representing millions of people with pre-existing conditions. These organizations include the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, and the ALS Association, to name just a few. And this collaboration resulted in the creation of a document called the 100 Days Agenda, a patient-first blueprint. The agenda outlines the specific steps the president and other elected officials can take immediately after they're sworn into office to protect access to adequate, affordable coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. This patient-first blueprint also includes steps that policymakers can take to address harmful policies that undermine patient protections. And if you'd like to review this first-of-its-kind document, I'll include a link in today's show notes. A research team in Italy analyzed data from 45 randomized clinical trials for disease-modifying therapies that have since been approved, and they discovered that the use of cell-depletive disease-modifying therapies in adults with MS increased the risk of precancerous growth among those clinical trial participants who were over the age of 45. Since disease-modifying therapies have an impact on the immune system, people taking these therapies may have a reduced immune capacity to recognize and fight abnormal cell growth, which could evolve into cancer. Given the fact that depletive disease-modifying therapies are designed to deplete specific cells in the immune system, and the fact that as we all age, there's a gradual deterioration of the immune system, this phenomenon isn't difficult to understand. Now, this is just one study, and as the MS patient population continues to grow older, we're seeing more research focused on better understanding how age impacts MS and how MS impacts age. So you can expect to hear much more about what I'll call age-centric studies like this one. And if you'd like to review the details of this study, You'll find a link in today's show notes. I want to tell you about several excellent webcasts and virtual conferences coming up during the next couple of weeks, and you can view all of them at no charge in the comfort of your own home. So I hope you'll plan on carving out some time to hear directly from some of the foremost MS experts in the world. On November 12th at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, the International Progressive MS Alliance is hosting a global webcast on speeding life-changing treatments for progressive MS. This webcast will feature world-class MS researchers discussing how a blood test and the use of artificial intelligence in MRIs could both be real game changers when it comes to predicting progressive MS before MS progresses. Even before the COVID-19 pandemic struck, a growing number of Americans were already challenged with family caregiving responsibilities, managing their own health, and having difficulties balancing work and those caregiving responsibilities. A recent report from the Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregiving found that 83% of family caregivers reported increased stress related to caregiving since the start of the pandemic. This is a potentially dangerous situation for family caregivers and the loved ones they care for. On November 18th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, the National Alliance for Caregiving and the Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregiving are teaming up to present a webinar entitled Flattening the Caregiver Crisis Curve, where a panel of experts will not only explore the challenges facing family caregivers, but offer real solutions designed to improve a caregiver's health, strength, and resilience. In last week's episode of Real Talk MS, we talked about some very disturbing survey results that showed 40% of the people living with advanced MS reported being mistreated by their family caregivers. I'll say this as plainly as I know how. We, and that's the entire MS community, can't allow this dangerous trend to continue. Often, patient mistreatment is the final step in what starts out as a family caregiver feeling overwhelmed. So learning how to manage or avoid some of the stress and anxiety that come along with being a caregiver, well, that's something that should be at the top of every caregiver's to-do list. If you're an MS caregiver or you know one, I hope you'll be tuned in to this well-timed webinar. On November 19th and 20th, the European Multiple Sclerosis Platform is hosting its annual conference. This year, of course, it's a virtual conference, and you won't have to worry about feeling lost in a jungle of scientific jargon, because this conference is specifically aimed at people affected by MS. The theme of the conference is Understanding Progressive Multiple Sclerosis, and the conference features expert presentations on a broad range of topics, including aging with progressive MS, current trends in progressive MS rehabilitation, dealing with the emotions that come from living with progressive MS, and others. There are 2 days of excellent speakers, presentations, and plenty of time for connecting with other virtual attendees. I'll be serving as moderator during the 2-day conference, so I hope you'll be joining me online. Finally, from November 23rd through the 28th, the MS Society of Canada is hosting the 2020 MS Connect Conference. This is another conference that's specifically aimed at people affected by MS, and this year, MS Connect is going virtual, connecting thousands of people to hear about the progress being made in MS research. You'll find some of the top MS researchers talking about restoring lost function, managing cognitive dysfunction, managing fatigue, and living well with MS. I'm looking forward to participating in MS Connect, and whether you happen to live in Canada or elsewhere, I hope you'll find time to virtually attend what's going to be an excellent event. You'll find links to online registration for each of these upcoming events in today's show notes. And while we're talking about important dates that are coming up this month, I think perhaps the most important date of all is tomorrow, November 11th. When we honor the men and women who have served in America's armed forces by celebrating Veterans Day. More than 70,000 U.S. veterans are living with MS, and today we're going to meet one of them. Carla Clay is an Air Force veteran and a National Veterans Wheelchair Games multiple medal winner. And Carla is an MS difference maker. In a moment, we'll meet Carla Clay. More than 70,000 U.S. veterans are living with multiple sclerosis, and my guest today is one of them. Carla Clay served as a captain in the United States Air Force, and in 2001, Carla was diagnosed with MS. Welcome to the podcast, Carla.
Thank you, John.
So, get us started by telling us a little bit about your career in the service.
Sure. I had a wonderful job in the service, John. I was commissary officer, which meant I managed the grocery store on base and also the troop support, the rations. And most of my employees were civilians. I had a few military people that reported to me. And I think it was a great job because it translated very easily outside of the service. It was something that really helped set me up to have a great career afterwards. But anyway, I was commissary officer, and it was so funny when I got my assignment, graduated from college, got commissioned, and I found out I was going to be commissary officer, and I thought, oh my goodness, they want me to manage a grocery store? What do I know? I'd worked in a department store in college briefly, but I thought, this is crazy. But of course, it was on-the-job training, so I learned how to manage the store by literally working in every department. I mentioned to somebody recently that I'll never forget the first time I went into the meat market. They didn't warn me that they were cutting sides of cattle in the meat. I mean, they were actually meat cutters there back in the day. This was back in 82. So when I first went in there, you walk in and there's this huge refrigerator sized, a room sized refrigerator with all of these dead cows hanging up basically. And of course I couldn't show, I had to, you know, show that I was still in, you know, in charge, and I wasn't frightened or daunted by it. But it was a horrified sight to see it. I could still smell it. But anyway, thankfully, I didn't have to cut meat while I was there, but I did learn what the process was, learned how to run the cash register, how to go through the produce and display it and all that, because I needed to know those things in order to manage the people who actually did it. But it was great. My first base was at McCord Air Force Base in Tacoma, Washington, so it was outside of Seattle. It's just beautiful and very different from the area where I grew up, which is Memphis. But it was gorgeous because of the mountains and the snow-capped mountains and the evergreens everywhere. And I remember my first impression of McCord was that it was raining every day. In my mind, it was rainy. There was constant mist, pretty much. And I went around probably for the first 3 or 4 days with my little Air Force raincoat and my little Air Force cap, a rain cap. And I finally realized I was the only person with a raincoat. This is just the way it was. But it was a great opportunity for me to learn about how to manage a store, how to manage people. It was a great experience. Wow. After I left there, I went to a couple of other bases. Up in Montana, I went to Malmstrom Air Force Base, and Bergstrom Air Force Base down in Austin, Texas was my last base. And I did commissary management the whole time.
And then we fast forward to 2001, when you received your MS diagnosis. Tell us what that experience was like.
Sure. Throughout the years, even starting when I was in the military, I had little things that would happen that I kind of brushed off, or a doctor brushed off as just some kind of visual problem or vertigo. Or I had when I was in the military, I'll never forget, I would have the sensation that somebody was touching my side or my shoulder or my hip, and there was no one there. And I didn't want to report that because I knew they would think I was psychotic, you know. But it turns out that was I can't remember the exact term, but there's a term related to that with MS, where you feel a sensation that there's, you know, spiders crawling up your arm or something, and that's not as something going on with your nerves. But I was brushed off with, had vertigo. I had a pinched nerve that was just irritated. But finally, in 2001, I had an MRI done for some because of orthopedic problems I was having. And that doctor noticed some plaques on the MRI that he thought were MS. He did not tell me that. He just referred me to a neurologist. And when I went to the neurologist, and I kind of had a sense of what was going on because I knew some people with MS. And so I asked him, he said, yeah, I think that's what it is. And he continued the test and told me. So I was kind of stunned, but it was good to have a handle on things. You know, it's good to know that all of these things might be connected and that there is something that could be done to at least slow the course down. So I started on Avonex within a month and a half of diagnosis.
What went through your mind once you were diagnosed and all of these random symptoms kind of made a little more sense in the big picture? How did you feel?
Well, I was frustrated because there's no known cause and no cure for it. It's not a new disease, obviously, in terms of, you know, it being recognized by the medical community. So that was frustrating. One of the things that my doctor referred me to was the National MS Society. And I was fortunate that I lived probably 7 or 8 miles from the local office here in Dallas. And that became one of my safe havens. I would go not only to meetings, but I would go and just read books in the library and learn about different things. So that was really, National MS Society really had my back in the day and still do. What was going through my head was just, you know, what is tomorrow going to look like? Will I end up, you know, in a wheelchair? Will I be one of the ones who has little residual effects?
I want to circle back to the MS Society and you in just a minute, but I just wanted to ask, even though your MS wasn't confirmed until 2001, is it classified as service-connected?
Yes, it is classified as service-connected. I had some things, some medical things in the military that they determined were related to MS, so I am service-connected.
So I'm curious, how did your life change in the years following your diagnosis?
I had to make sure that I adhered to my medication and schedule and going to many more doctor's appointments than I ever had in my life. I started going to specialists for a number of different things. And to the average person, my outward appearance would tell no one that I had MS. I didn't have anything that other people could see until about, I guess in the late 90s, I started stumbling every now and then or tripping, and every now and then I'd fall. Later on, we realized it was because I was dragging my right leg. And sure enough, I remember many years ago wondering, why are the toes of other people's shoes don't get stuck? Mine gets stuck. So it was because I was dragging my foot. And look at the bottom of my shoe, you can see the wear pattern from the drag. I just had to deal with things as they came and trust that the doctors could guide me, and I did. And over the years, I have done different medications, and I hope that it has helped to slow it. The interesting thing I thought of, kind of frustrating thing about MS is that although you can take medications that are disease-modifying, and that are designed to slow the progress, there's no way to really know if that's what it did. You know, there's nothing that can compare to say, if Carla hadn't taken this, she would have gone down this path and she would have progressed to this point, and the medication slowed things down. So I am somewhat of a skeptic, but I do take them and have taken the medications up until recently.
Well, if it's any consolation to you, while they can't exactly tell what Carla would have been like without her disease-modifying therapies, what researchers can do is they go back and they look at medical records of an awful lot of people like Carla, and some of them who were on disease-modifying therapies and some of them who were not. And they kind of separate those two groups out on paper, and they take a look at what was their disease progression like? And very, very often it turns out that the group on disease modifying therapy benefited by not having to deal with as much progression as soon as the other group. Mm-hmm. So if you can believe in the statistical analysis, I hope that gives you a little bit of peace of mind in terms of the fact of doing that. So in 2015, your doctor at the VA tells you about the National Veteran Wheelchair Games. Then what happened?
And I thought that was funny that she would suggest it to me because I was never athletic. And but she told me who to talk to. And so I spoke with some of the other veterans and I said, but I won't make the team. I thought you would have to try out, like in high school, how you tried out for basketball. And they said, oh, no, you don't have to try out. Just come and just pick your sports and you can do them. And I thought, but I don't know any sports. The recreation therapists were wonderful because they taught me how to do different sports. They would teach you any of the events that you want to compete in. And one of the great things about that is that it introduced me to a lot of other veterans because we will practice together. So I've made a lot of good friends and I've actually learned some things. I'd never picked up a javelin. I'd never seen a javelin in real life, let alone thrown it, but I know how to do that and throw discus and do other things that I just never crossed my mind. So I highly encourage any veterans to get involved. And then I encourage other people to get involved as volunteers because people have told me that that's very, very rewarding to participate as a volunteer.
So which events did you compete in?
I competed in track and 100 meters, bowling, bocce ball, I've thrown the discus and javelin, and that's it. And I'm sitting where I have my medals here. I have my medals on display at my house.
So I'm gonna brag a little bit on your behalf, and I hope I get it right, but I think we're talking about a medal count over 5 National Veteran Wheelchair Games. You've gained 3 gold medals, 6 silver, and 2 bronze. Do I have that right?
I think you're right. That's correct.
I think that makes you an elite athlete.
Well, John, I have to admit something, and I admit this freely to people. The reason that I have these medals is that in some of my competitions, I have no competitors because you compete against people that are in a similar physical condition as you are, and also age group, and also males. You know, I've only competed against women in most of my events. So in a lot of things, I'm not competing against another person. So that's how I got the medal.
Okay, fair enough. But I'm going to tell a different side of that same story. And I would like to at least suggest that the very fact that you went from someone who had never done any sort of athletic competition, didn't know what a javelin was, to even deciding you're going to show up and you're going to put in the work to be there and do this. I mean, to me, that's what the medal's all about, because there's an awful lot of other folks who faced with the same realities would simply say, well, I don't do this. It's not for me. And you were willing to kind of extend yourself and try something new. And it turned out to be something that seems like you really took to.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, John. And my doctor has observed that it has helped me to kind of bloom as a person. When I went to the VA before I got involved, I would stick to myself. You would see me over in a corner reading. And if someone spoke to me, I would, nod, say hello, and that was it. I didn't have conversations. I didn't talk to people. And once I started with the National Veterans Wheelchair Games training, I started talking to people and meeting people, and we would go to the track together and do different things together. We would even do outside of the National Veterans Wheelchair Games, the recreation therapists would take us places in the city to get us out of the VA, out of our normal place, and go out and do, we did indoor skydiving. I've gone rowing on one of the lakes here, something I've never been on a boat of that type and never tried rowing. That was hard. But the National Veterans Wheelchair Games were really the thing that opened up all of that, because it introduced me to the recreation therapy program. And training for the wheelchair games is great, because it helps. It's great exercise to do the different events that I did. And those were things that I probably exercised that I would not have gotten had I not been involved. So it helped me. I've lost weight. Because when I got a new wheelchair, the new one was the same model as the old one, but it's 2 inches narrower, because I've lost enough weight that I didn't need the larger wheelchair. And it's gotten me in shape. My arms look great. I love wearing short tops, short sleeves or sleeveless things, because my arms have some definition to them. I don't have I'm 60 years old, but I don't have the chicken flap, wing flap when I wave. So the National Veterans Wheelchair Games has really been, it's been a life changer for me. It really has. And I really, when I meet people, other veterans who are in wheelchairs, I encourage them to get involved. And several people that I've done that with have come back to me later or remarked later that they are so glad that I talked them into it, because it's really great. And the games, I have no cost to go to the game. The Paralyzed Veterans of America sponsor it, and they provide the airfare and the hotel and visa cards so you can get your meals wherever you want. And I do that. I earn that right from the PCA by volunteering. And I volunteer at the VA in order to not only to gain the passage to the games, but also to help people, obviously. And volunteering has been a lot of fun as well.
While there isn't a cure for multiple sclerosis, it sounds like the games are quite a cure for the isolation that can sometimes accompany disability. Sounds like they, as you said, have been a real life changer for you.
Absolutely, John. You nailed it. And it really has helped to prevent the isolation, gotten me out of my house instead of sitting in looking at these four walls all the time. I can go out and do some different activities with people and, laugh and joke and learn how to do things. So the National Veterans Wheelchair Games, I am just so thankful that that exists, and grateful to my doctor for encouraging me to participate, because had she not said that, I probably would not have done it. The games happened to be in Dallas that year, and they wanted to get as many local people involved. But if my doctor had not said that, I probably would have, noticed the poster on the wall that talks about it, but I would not have pursued it. I'm pretty sure I would not have. And now it's so funny that after seeing that poster on the wall and not really paying attention, a couple of years later, I was one of the athletes on the poster. So it kind of turned back to laugh at me. Look, you didn't think it was much before, but now look at you. So I can't say enough good things, obviously, about the games, because it's been a life changer.
So a minute ago, I said I wanted to circle back to talking about the National MS Society. And the reason I wanted to do that is in your email to me, you described the MS Society as a lifeline for you. What did you mean by that?
Well, when I was first diagnosed, my doctor encouraged me to investigate what the National MS Society had to offer in terms of programming, in terms of materials. And so I joined the local MS support group, and I would go to meetings early, go a couple hours early, so I could go through the library and read materials or borrow things from them. It really was great, because there was somebody there to talk to who understood MS, who could kind of gently guide me toward materials that might answer the questions that I had. So it really, really was a great resource for me, and still is. And I encourage people who are, especially the newly diagnosed, to check in with their local National MS Society, because it really is a great resource.
What's next for you, Carla?
Well, next year I'm going to the National Veterans Wheelchair Games in New York City. I invite you to come. because it would be a great opportunity for you to meet a lot of veterans and see what this is all about. But that's on my horizons. Right now, I'm not traveling, and I'm staying pretty much at home because I know that I don't want to, you know, be exposed to COVID-19, because I realize having MS puts you in kind of a higher risk category because of how, you know, what happens could happen if I got infected. I've broken bones 4 different times, John, from falling. And so I have to be extra careful about infections because my gait and balance are 2 of my main symptoms of MS that I battle.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're staying safe right now. And I hope I have an opportunity to take you up on that offer and meet you at the games next year.
That sounds great. The MS Society is always there. They always have a booth at the expo. And so you would have an opportunity to meet a lot of other veterans.
Well, Carla Clay, I want to thank you for your service as we recognize all of our veterans this Veterans Day. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks for the opportunity, John. I appreciate it. God bless you.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/167. You'll find that link in today's show notes so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. I don't think that I have to tell anyone listening to this podcast that the COVID-19 pandemic has intensified and in some cases multiplied the challenges of living with MS. More than ever before, people living with MS need access to reliable information, support, and connection. We're witnessing that even during a pandemic, MS doesn't stop. And neither does the National MS Society. With vital funding from supporters like you, the National MS Society is continuing to meet the urgent and expanding needs of the MS community during these unprecedented times, while ensuring that the MS research community rebounds quickly from COVID-19, so that the progress and momentum toward finding a cure continues. And that's why I hope that as you're able, you'll make a donation to the Society's COVID-19 Response Fund. It couldn't be easier. Just text the word GIVE to 68686, and you'll get a link right to the MS Society's COVID-19 Response Fund webpage. I hope you'll consider contributing today, because it's never been more important. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.